This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. The 6888 is an award-winning documentary that tells the story of the only all-black female unit to serve overseas during World War II. The women of the 6888th Central Postal Directory Battalion trained at Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia, before shipping out in February 1945 to serve in Birmingham, England and Paris. Next Thursday, the documentary will be screened on this campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, starting at 3 p.m. in the University Center Auditorium. Chris McKeever is Executive Director of the 6th Cavalry Museum in Fort Oglethorpe, one of the sponsors, along with UTC, of the documentary's premiere here in Chattanooga. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Tell me when you first learned about this battalion.
Well, it was about 8 months ago. A husband and wife from North Carolina came and sought out the museum, the 6th Cavalry Museum in Fort Oglethorpe. And they told the story of their neighbor, Edna Cummings, who helped produce a documentary about the 6888 Central Postal Directory Battalion for World War II. And she wanted to see what the museum had on display relating to the 6888. And we didn't have anything on display. And she went on to tell me that the 6888 was an all-black Women's Army Corps unit. And they came to Fort Oglethorpe and received their overseas training before they were sent to Europe in 1945.
All-black and all-female.
All-black, all-female. And they also had all-black and all-female officers, which all of your other black Women's Army Corps units had white officers at the time.
During World War II, the armed forces of the United States were segregated.
Yes, they were. And of course, before there ever was the city of Fort Oglethorpe, there was the Army post at Fort Oglethorpe. And so from 1902 through 1947, there was an active Army post in the area now, which is the city of Fort Oglethorpe. And we had the 3rd Women's Army Corps Training Center, which was the largest in the country. And so your typical training is for 6 weeks. And so thousands of women came through and were trained at Fort Oglethorpe, African American and white as well. And then when it came time to pull together the 6888, women were sent to Fort Oglethorpe to make up that 855 women from all over the country. And so it was very much women from the east, the west, up north, down south. And so it was just a very diverse group of African American women who found themselves together doing their overseas training in Fort Oglethorpe.
And where they were deployed, it was toward the end of the war, England.
Yes, Birmingham, England. And so the what makes the 6888 so unique is that they were the only all-black WAC unit sent over for Europe.
Women's Army Corps.
Women's Army Corps for World War II. They were the only ones that were sent over. And the Army, of course, as you said, was segregated at the time. And their point was the reason the black Women's Army Corps units had not been sent over is that they had not been requested. And they hid behind that for years. But Eleanor Roosevelt was very much a proponent of the African-American women getting their fair share. And so 10% of the Women's Army Corps total that could be soldiers during that time period, 10% had to be African-American. And she stuck to her guns and had other famous people helping her with that. And these ladies were selected. They had to be approved to come in, and they were sent over to Birmingham, England, because the mail hadn't been delivered to the soldiers for years. And so they took on the motto, no mail, low morale. And they went over to Birmingham, England. They were there for just 3 months. And during that time, between there and when they ended up in France for 3 more months, they identified and got delivered 17 million pieces of mail.
And these were pieces of mail that were for the soldiers fighting on continental Europe.
Yes. And at the time, you know, in today's world, oh, you look them up on the internet and life is good. You go on your tablet and you put in your change of address and everybody knows what it is. Well, back then, everything was done by paper. So you have soldiers that are fighting a world war, and probably the lowest thing, especially if they're engaged in combat, is, oh, I need to fill out a change of address and send it so that I get my mail. So these women were faced with 17 million pieces of mail, and there were no APO or FPO addresses back then. And so it might say Jim Smith, U.S. Army. Well, there were, 7,500 Jim Smiths in the Army for World War II. And so you had to find that one that matched that envelope and that letter. And it was just a huge undertaking. And the ladies knew that all eyes would be upon them and that this was their chance to show that they belonged in the Army and that they belonged to the patriotic mood that was across the country, and they wanted to go over there and prove to everybody that even though they were African American and were not as accepted as they should have been at that time period, they went over there and did a heck of a job. And they got through all that mail in 6 months' time.
And they had to adjust to life in Birmingham, England, at a time where the British Empire was still very much the British Empire.
Yes. And when they got over to Europe, they were accepted far better in Europe than they ever were here at home. We have instances of them, Charity Adams, who was the colonel, she was the commanding officer, she and her other black female officers, they go to the officers' club in Fort Oglethorpe for dinner. Well, that's what you do. You're an officer, you go to the officers' club for dinner. And in her book, she talks about how they were totally looked past, and they were told to go sit over there, and, oh, we don't have tables, you know, we won't be able to feed you dinner, that type of thing, because they did not want African-American female officers in the all-white Army Officers Club. And she said that they were not leaving, and they waited for hours. And finally, the staff at the Officers Club figured out that we're going to have to seat them, we're going to have to feed them. And it is just such a touching way to see these women who left their families, left their careers, left their education, whatever they gave up to be part of the Army to help in World War II, to see how poorly they were treated right here at Fort Oglethorpe. I did not expect to read that. It just was a very eye-opening experience for me.
After their service, were they properly recognized and then forgotten, or were they not properly recognized to begin with?
From what I've been told in the different things that I've read, the women came back. A lot of them made good use of the GI Bill and bettered themselves. But as for their unit being identified for breaking not only the female barrier, but also the African American barrier in World War II, they were never recognized. And that is why the push is to have them receive the Congressional Gold Medal for their service during World War II.
Because by the time they had completed their service, Eleanor Roosevelt was no longer First Lady. Franklin Roosevelt had died in office.
Right. The war was over. The women were glad to get home. Many of them stayed in the Army. Many of them did not. And there's all kinds of, I think what brought a lot of attention to them is with the Greatest Generation and the all of the anniversaries of World War II. And as our World War II soldiers are passing, a lot more attention is brought to bear. And so stories and newspaper articles came to be done. And all of a sudden, this is a fascinating story that we as Americans need to know. And our kids need to know this story. And that's why the museum was so excited to be a part of it.
Tell us more about the documentary.
The documentary, we're so excited that the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga is going to show it for us. Brewer Media has stepped in to help with it. And of course, stations like yours that help promote it. We had the opportunity to show the documentary and to bring the executive director, James Theris, and one of the producers is retired Army Colonel Edna Cummings. And so we're going to show the documentary on February 13th at 3 o'clock in the University Center. And following that, there will be a panel discussion. And so questions will be asked of Jim and Edna. We also have Beverly Foster, who is the president of the Walker County, Georgia African American Association, and Brian Autry from the Chattanooga and Chickamauga National Military Park. He's one of their interpretive rangers, and he has spent a lot of time studying up and learning the history of the 6888.
And you talked earlier about how we're hearing stories from the last of the greatest generation, and it's important to record those stories while they can still be told by the people who live them. And that applies here to the women of the 6888 and the African American community in Chattanooga in the Tennessee Valley.
Very much so. And we have a list. There's a Facebook page for the 6888, and they have compiled all the women that they know of from each of the states and where they served from. And so we went on and looked up the states closest to us. Georgia had 42 women listed. Tennessee had 11, and Alabama had 25. And we would love to hear from any 6888 family members who can remember the stories that their mother, their aunt, their grandmother might have told. If they have any letters or mementos or artifacts from when they served in the 6888, we will be doing a static display at the museum to bring attention to the 6888 and to become a part of our school day program that we teach to fifth graders.
And where can people go online for more information about the museum, including how to contact you?
We have a wonderful website. It is 6calvarymuseum.org. And of course, our 6th is the number 6, T-H. Cavalry is spelled militarily, which is C-A-V-A-L-R-Y, museum.org. And our phone number is 706-861-2860.
All right, Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
10 years ago, the Scottsboro Boys Museum and Cultural Center opened in Alabama. The museum remembers the 9 black teenagers wrongfully convicted of raping 2 white women while traveling through Jackson County, Alabama by train in 1931. Last weekend, the museum marked its 10th anniversary and is looking ahead. Sheila Washington founded the museum. Sheila, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me when you first heard about the Scottsboro case.
I was 17 years old, and my parents had a pillowcase under the bed, the only thing that was under the bed. And I would have to vacuum their bedroom every Saturday, and I wondered what was in that pillowcase. So when I finally got the nerve to open the pillowcase, wrapped in plastic was a little paperback book, Haywood Patterson, Scottsboro Boys. I just said, oh, it's just a book. So I got the book and I started reading it. Halfway through, my father saw me reading the book and took it away. He said he didn't want me reading. It was too much hurtful, harmful things that I didn't need to know about. So he took it away. And at 18, my oldest brother was in Kilby Prison, the same prison the Scottsboro Boys was housed in. And he was murdered. And I found that book again, and I read the book all the way through. And in my mind, I said, one day I'm going to find a place and put my little paperback book and a candle in honor of the Scottsboro Boys and my brother. And little did I know, the vision was much bigger than a table and a candle.
And when did you realize that vision was much larger than that?
Well, it took me 35 years talking about it, trying to get to the place where I need to be. When I mentioned it one day at City Hall, they were going to do a historical working trail. I was the first black to ever work at City Hall, the only black that worked at City Hall. And I said to the mayor, oh, wouldn't it be good to do something for the Scottsboro Boys? And he pointed his finger at the tip of my nose and said, leave that dead dog sleeping, and you better not do anything to resurrect it. So I had 22 years in with the city, and little did I know that the personnel manager was first cousin to Victoria Price, who lied on the boys and recanted her story on her deathbed. And she came up and said, young lady, if you want to keep your job, you keep your mouth shut about the Scottsboro Boys. So I lost my job, and after 22 years, didn't know what I was going to do. But God had given me purpose and destiny. If I hadn't lost my job, the museum would never have opened. So that gave me time to focus on the museum. In 2005, I started working, trying to find a place, started talking about the Scottsboro Boys case. When people came in town, we had nowhere to meet. We had to meet in either in the courtroom or in the summer times on the grounds at another museum. And I said, we need to find a place to house things on the Scottsboro Boys. So I went into what they call a railroad depot that was sitting empty. And we began to meet. And when I filed paperwork to get a 501c3, I was asked to get the stuff out of the railroad depot because they knew what I was getting ready to do. So we had to move all of our stuff out. In 2009, I found a church that was up for sale. It was a black church. It got down to three black women, and they couldn't keep it up any longer. And I called the presiding elder over the United Methodist Church and talked to him about how much you want for the church. He said $145,000. And I said, oh, that's a lot of money. And then he asked, well, what do you want to do with it? And I said, make it out of a museum. So we talked for 2 hours. When we got off the phone, the church was dropped the price of it to $75,000. And he said, how are you going to pay for it? I said, I don't know. When are you going to pay for it? I don't know. We came in December 2009. Open house and called it the Scottsboro Boys Museum and Culture Center. It went out all around the world that Scottsboro was finally going to have a place for the Scottsboro Boys. And everybody was happy except for Scottsboro. They started telling me it wasn't time. They didn't want to be known as this. Don't do it. Let it die. Let it stay dead. Don't do anything to resurrect it. And I had meetings after meetings with the powers to be in this town telling me that. So we went ahead and had the open house. People started sending donations. And a Jewish family, because of the Jewish lawyer that represented those boys for all the time they were locked up, heard that I was having problems raising the money. And they going to give me all the money. And I told them, no, just give me half of it, because our state legislator had promised me that they was going to pay for the building. And when the word got out that they were going to use tax dollars to buy that museum, they backed out of it and said, if I come up with half of it, they will give me the other half. And so I told the Jewish family, just give me half of it. And within 5 days, I had a check, and I carried it over to our legislative office. And it took them a whole week to honor their agreement with me. They couldn't believe I came up with the money that quick. So we paid for the church in April of 2010. I officially opened in February of 2010. I opened the first day of February, so I could always remember that was the first day of Black History. And this is Black History, this case.
When people walk into the museum, what do they see? What do they learn?
Well, some people walk in and they don't even make it towards the front. They just sit down on the back and start crying. I had one man that called it the sins of their fathers. He said he was a 12-year-old boy. And although those 9 boys didn't get hung that day because it was a posse there waiting on them because of a fight that broke out between 4 black boys and 2 white ones, and the sheriff had deputized a lot of men to take these 4 black boys to jail. And little did they know that 2 women were on the train, and when they got off, you're going to take us to jail after what they did to us. And they said rape. And, you know, it should have been a hanging right then of killing one. And immediately Victoria Price picked out 9 innocent black boys. And that's what touches people's heart, because no crime was ever committed. And this case went on for years. The state of Alabama dug a hole so deep, they were too embarrassed to come out and say, we made a mistake. 6 years later, in Decatur, the doctor finally told the judge and the lawyers and the state prosecutor that those girls had never been raped. So at that very moment, 4 of them was released and 5 were still retained. So when they come into the museum, we tell them the history. They see the pictures. We have things that was used during the trial. We have the original table that they sat at in the jail cell, chairs that was used during the jury and the witness stand chairs, and a lot of history and books and pictures and different things like that. And when they leave there with a sense of forgiveness and understanding that this was a tragedy in American history.
And it took a long time for the state to acknowledge that it did make a mistake.
Well, one morning I had a school there, and we was watching a documentary from PBS. And when George Wallace pardoned Clarence North, he said no crime was ever committed. When George Wallace said no crime was ever committed, something just hit me. I said, well, if he said that about Clarence North, then that means the rest of the boys is innocent. So right then I started in my head making preparations to try to get the Scottrie boys. I thought I wanted to use the word pardon, but they didn't do anything to be pardoned with. So I used the word exonerated. So I got a team of people to start working with me, and our local legislative office and Huntsville representatives and Decatur, because all three of those counties was involved with this trial. The girls lived in Huntsville, the trials were held in Decatur, and Scottsboro was the one that rushed to judgment and found them guilty. So we got the petition ready and got it before Governor Bentley, and when he came to Scottsboro, April of 2013, he said it's never too late to correct a wrong. And the state of Alabama finally corrected that wrong when they exonerated 9 black men in one day and gave 3 of them posthumous pardons after death. And also attached to the exoneration is a Scottsboro Boys Act, where if you can prove a family member is innocent 50 years back, they can be posthumous pardoned after death.
Over the past 10 years, has the mood in and around Scottsboro shifted about the museum, or is it still very much as you described it when you were trying to get it built in the first place?
Well, most of our support comes from out of town. We're on the National Civil Rights Trail, and we have picked up a lot of traffic from being on the National Civil Rights Trail. But just last year in November, the city of Scottsboro gave a first donation to the museum because we're going on a complete renovation, $20,000 for us to use towards the renovation of the museum. And the mood of the people, I would say it's about the same. We don't have a lot of Scottsboro people to come to the museum. We have a lot of schools from the county, Leadership Jackson County, and things like that, but Scottsboro City Schools have never been to the museum.
Tell me more about the anniversary gathering over the weekend and how people should be thinking about Scottsboro all through Black History Month and beyond.
Well, we had a large panel. We had a panel with the Speaker of the House, Montgomery. We had the mayor there, our local state senator. We had the state tourism director. We had Judge John Graham, who was the judge that had to sign the paperwork to get the exoneration passed here. It was over 200, and I think it was about 280 people that showed up for the 10th anniversary celebration of the Scottsboro Boys Museum. That was a huge crowd in support of what we're trying to do. And what Scottsboro got to take note of, that this is a part of history, and it's not going anywhere. It's already written. The story has been told. Every criminal lawyer has to study this case in law school. It's known around the world. We've had 14 foreign countries, 14 authors of different books to come to that museum, and thousands of visitors to walk through those doors. So what they got to understand is it's here and it's here to stay. We don't know anybody. The doors are open, and hopefully we get finances to have it open more during the week. I'm the only one that's giving tours right now, so I don't mind doing it. But when the renovation takes place, the museum is going to talk to you. So if people want to see the museum now, the way it looks, they need to come, because within a couple of weeks, we're going to start the renovation.
And where can people go online for more information about the museum?
We're creating a new website on the museum, so our website is down at the moment. We have a Facebook page that one of our board members keeps up and keeps pictures going, and we talk about donations. They can mail it to a post office box, P.O. Box 1557, and we're going to take pictures as we go along and post them to let people see what's going on at the museum when we start the renovation.
All right, Sheila, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Here on the UTC campus, Dr. Hill Craddock will tell you plenty about the American chestnut. His research is focused on restoring the tree to the southern Appalachian hardwood forest. A while back, he stopped by Scenic Roots. Hill, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
So how long have you been focused on the chestnut tree?
My first interest in chestnut, actually, I was a teenager. I grew some chestnut seeds that a neighbor gave me, and so that's when I became interested. Then I started reading about the chestnut tree and realized it was a very worthy group of species, but there were a lot of problems. I've been continuously, more or less, on and off working with chestnut trees since I was about 15 years old.
And we should talk about what are the problems.
First of all, there are chestnut species in East Asia. There's a chestnut species in Europe, and then there are two or three species in North America. And wherever they grow, they're important ecologically and economically. They're useful trees for people. They produce a delicious edible nut that wildlife appreciates. So in all the places where they're grown, they've been traditionally very, very important for the local economy and ecologically. They form what I would call the foundational species for their forest type. So we even refer to the chestnut forest as a kind of forest type. There's two terrible fungus diseases, both originating in Eastern Asia, that affect the chestnuts in Europe and in North America. So the North American species in particular, the one we call the American chestnut, was almost completely destroyed by one of these two fungi. And so it's the fungus that causes the disease. We call it the chestnut blight. So the chestnut blight was discovered in New York City in the early 20th century. By the middle of the 20th century, it had completely removed the American chestnut from its ecological niche as a forest canopy tree. It's not extinct. There's still lots of chestnut trees out there, but now they grow as an understory shrub. So they're no longer tall forest trees in the forest canopy. They persist weakly, sort of tenuously, as an understory shrub. And there's been a cycle of sprouting and then blight and then sprouting and blight since the early 20th century.
And this is what you mean by when you say not extinct, but functionally extinct.
Functionally extinct means that they don't have an opportunity to reproduce sexually. So there's no flowering in the shade. So in the forest understory, it's a very shady spot. And so the trees are just barely surviving. They're sort of eking out an existence, growing very slowly, maintaining themselves almost. Of course, any habitat destruction or alteration, habitat alteration, can be extirpated from that local environment very easily. Occasionally, a tree is lucky and escapes blight long enough to bloom. We hear about those through our network of volunteers and other interested folks who bring it to our attention, and I will jump in my car and drive 200 miles to go see a chestnut tree in bloom. Very rarely, two trees will bloom close enough together to produce seed in the wild, and we can collect seed from naturally occurring American chestnuts. So that does happen. Consider that the range goes from Mississippi and Alabama all the way up through the Appalachian Range into Maine and parts of southern Canada. So we're talking about a large area. It does happen. We get seeds from these naturally occurring trees. So we speak in very big, broad generalizations. Yes, it's true they're functionally extinct, but really there is flowering and we do have some opportunities to collect seed every year.
What would it take to progress beyond what we're seeing now?
Well, so we don't have a cure for the disease, but there is an ongoing very broadly multidisciplinary project that involves plant pathology, you know, study of the disease itself, that involves plant breeding, which is mostly what I do, and then some molecular biology solutions, some genetic engineering solutions that are being attempted. And so a combination of silviculture, which is how to grow trees in the forest, better nursery techniques for propagating them, better breeding, selecting for blight resistance among our hybrids, the genetic engineering solution, and then working on the pathogen itself. We have, I think the prognosis is actually very good for the future of the American chestnut by combining all these areas of research.
And you've been involved in this work going back to the 90s, a special role here at UTC.
I began collaborating with the American Chestnut Foundation, which is a small nonprofit group, acf.org, in the mid-1980s. I finished my doctorate work actually in Italy at the University of Torino in Turin, Italy. So I was in Italy for 7 years, but I maintained my collaboration with the Chestnut Foundation. When I got to Chattanooga, and I should say I was invited to Chattanooga by a chestnut enthusiast who had heard me speak at an international chestnut conference. It was William Raoul of Lookout Mountain, the legendary William Raoul, invited me to come to Chattanooga for a job interview at UTC. And he set the whole thing up and actually arranged for an endowed chair and a research endowment. That was in the late 1990s. And so I started here at UTC in 1996 with an endowment, a research endowment. It's actually the Summerfield Johnson Endowment for the Restoration of the American Chestnut. And then there is a Robert Davenport Chair in Biology. So I take advantage of those two funds to support graduate research and undergraduate research here at UTC. William invited me to come. I was working on a postdoc in McMinnville, Middle Tennessee. William invited me to come down and see what he was doing with a group of his chestnut enthusiast friends. They were participating in the chestnut breeding program of the American Chestnut Foundation. They had assembled a what we plant breeders call a germplasm collection. Now, germplasm, it sounds very sciencey, is an orchard of local American chestnuts that William and his volunteers had dug up from the wilderness and brought out to Bendabout Farm in Cleveland. They were growing in full sun now in an orchard where they could be watered and fertilized, and they were growing very quickly. And just about the time I got here in 1996, they were blooming. So we had an opportunity to breed them and to make the hybrids. I started that first year, 1996, on those first hybrids. His volunteers actually made those pollinations that year. And so we do cross-pollination. The project, which I was joining, was to make a hybrid that combines the timber form and all the other adaptive characteristics of the American chestnut with the blight resistance of the Asian species. So mostly the Chinese chestnut, but also the Japanese chestnut, they have genetic resistance to the fungus. The fungus will live on their bark, but it doesn't kill them. Typically, it can. They range from resistant to very highly resistant. And so the hybrids, the Chinese American and the Japanese American hybrids, are intermediate in blight resistance. So the idea is to do many generations, and at every generation we select for the American form, so a tall timber tree that's going to grow well in the forest here, that are adequately blight tolerant to survive blight long enough to bloom. So we've been working on that, as I said, in collaboration with this national program. And so we have a chapter in Tennessee. Each chapter is breeding locally. In other words, I don't want to replace the Tennessee American chestnut with something exotic. The way the breeding program is designed is to move the genes from the Asian species into the local population. So make a very big effort to collect American chestnuts from as local as possible. Consider for a moment we have three Tennessees. We've got West Tennessee, Middle Tennessee, and East Tennessee. We're keeping those American chestnuts separate. In other words, if we're going to be planting in the Blue Ridge, we want an East Tennessee source of American chestnut. Similarly for Middle Tennessee. West Tennessee chestnuts are very, very rare in West Tennessee. It's been very difficult to collect that germplasm. We are still currently looking for West Tennessee germplasm that we can include into our breeding program. The important thing is that those trees, those West Tennessee trees, they descend from trees that have lived there for thousands of years. And the assumption is that they have the adaptations required to grow well there. And so we don't want to replace those trees with a tree from East Tennessee, which have grown up in a very, very different environment. They've been selected for different adaptive traits.
Even with the trees around here in this state, you don't want to mix up East and West.
Like I said, it's an assumption that the best genes are probably the local genes. We know that from other examples in other tree species, that the provenance is very important to success in a forest-type planting. If you're replanting or doing afforestation, if you're converting some farmland into forest land, you need to be very careful about the source of the seed. Where does that seed come from? In almost every case, the most local source is the best source. We don't really know that for chestnut because we don't have enough to do that experiment. We don't have enough seeds to do that experiment, but we're sort of banking on that. And we've designed the whole program then to accommodate that. So I think of the work we're doing as primarily conservation. We're trying to conserve the existing genetic diversity in the species in every way we can. Let me change subjects for just a moment and talk about the other disease. The other disease is caused by a fungus-like microorganism. In other words, it's not truly a fungus. It's like a fungus. It has a terrible name. It's called Phytophthora cinnamomi, and it has the PHTH in the middle. Not everybody can say that. Phytophthora is another exotic pest, and it causes a root rot, which we call Phytophthora root rot. In Europe, it's called ink disease. And similar to the chestnut blight, the origin of these Phytophthoras is probably from East Asia. By the way, plant disease organisms, these fungi and fungus-like organisms move when we move plants. So when you buy nursery stock and you ship nursery stock and you move nursery stock from one place to another, you're bringing the disease organisms with them. So that's how the diseases got to the United States, on nursery stock. And it quickly spread in the South. So these Phytophthoras are limited by cold. Until very recently, they were restricted to the South, but we are seeing a northward movement. The very first occurrence of the Phytophthoras in Pennsylvania was just about 2 years ago. They're moving northward. Different from the chestnut blight, the root rot disease kills also the roots. So when the tree's dead, they're gone. There's no hope for recovery. The microorganism, this Phytophthora cinnamomi, persists in the soil also because it has a very wide host range. It can live on oak trees. It can live on fir trees. It can live on rhododendrons. If the Phytophthora occurs in that soil, you cannot grow American chestnuts there, ever. You never will be able to. You can't restore that soil. In other words, once the pathogen is there, it's there. So in this case, the only hope to restore chestnuts into those soils is through breeding or some other solution to bring resistance into the local population. Historically, it's been a southern problem, not north, and it's typically low elevation. Like I said, it is temperature limited. So at high elevations, it's not as problematic. And then it also depends on the soil type. Clayey soils are worse than sandy soils, et cetera. And so there are places in Tennessee where we can safely grow American chestnuts, but they're all at high elevations in eastern Tennessee. For middle Tennessee and western Tennessee, we're really stuck. So those naturally occurring wild trees that still exist out there are at extreme risk because this organism lives in the soil. If you track soil on your shoes, for instance, from a contaminated soil into the wilderness, you're essentially bringing the pathogen to these rare surviving trees in the forest. You might find out about a tree in the wilderness, or maybe it's on a mountain in somebody's backyard, and you go to look at that tree, and unwittingly, you have brought the very disease that's going to kill that tree. So we need to be very careful about our equipment, our machinery, and our shoes. Don't wear the same mud-crusted boots that you were in the orchard out into the wilderness, because you'll be bringing the pathogen into the wilderness and you could literally kill that last surviving American chestnut. So it's particularly critical in the South. We know from experiments we've done looking at the genetic diversity using DNA sequence similarities. We can make genomic comparisons of chestnut trees. The center of diversity for American chestnuts is in the South. It's probably, I'm going to make a big bold statement here, the center of diversity of North American chestnut is Northern Alabama. Mm-hmm. So there are more different kinds of chestnut trees in Alabama than anywhere else. And within the American chestnut, there are more differences at the genetic level, at the DNA level. Among them, within the Alabama population, there's more genetic variation than there is in the entire northeastern North America. They're very rare, but they're very, very important for a conservation point of view. So we're targeting a lot of our resources on finding and propagating these southernmost American chestnuts.
And where can people go online for more information?
The American Chestnut Foundation is one of the most important groups that's working on restoration and conservation of the American chestnut. We're certainly not the only game in town. There are other organizations that are involved. There is a small but very dedicated group of chestnut researchers spread thinly from Alabama to Maine. I think a clearinghouse for information should always be the American Chestnut Foundation's webpage, and that would be acf.org. There's plenty to read, and that's a good clearinghouse for information to link you to other research.
All right, Hill, thanks so much, and all the best.
Thank you, Ray.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. Our show is produced by Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis from the studios of WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Follow us on Twitter at @ScenicRoots423 and email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Also, follow WUTC on Facebook and Instagram and listen online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. Join us again next time for Scenic Roots.